sources in parallel at that point, and on the exact same network analyzer that has both been perfectly calibrated for a particular point, now with that new normalization at the end of the cable, I get on that Smith chart a single dot on the screen to the left of center at exactly 25 ohms resistive and 0 ohms reactive. Not only is there multiple ways of interpreting a simple resistive 2-to-1, depending on what length of cable and what frequency you're at, I can also get a zillion different ways of displaying it on the screen depending on how I calibrate the network analyzer. Ain't that crazy? But if you know what you're doing, it's very handy, because I may want to make a measurement on an antenna that's down in the hole, up in the air, on the top of a tower, way off in space somewhere, and I want to do it with a piece of cable. And my cable has got length that I can't cancel, and it's got insertion loss that I can't cancel. But if I can apply a calibration kit at the end of that cable, when it's connected to the analyzer, and I normalize at that point, it takes out all of that length error, it takes all of that impedance match error, it takes out all of the insertion loss error, and it acts as if my network analyzer, sitting on the ground, is really located 1,800 feet in the air, up at that transmitting antenna on the top of that tower. And I can get that answer for you by normalizing the analyzer at the end of that cable. You properly use that tool, and you can match anything, though. I am doing that as an occupation, and they pay me a lot of money to do it, and they're happy, and I'm happy, and it's a win-win situation. You learn that skill, and they will beat a path to your doorstep, Mr. Schneider. K2KEY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Roger, the K2RIW in the group,
K2KEY.
Okay. So basically, well, I'm going to put it down to a basic so I can more or less start, you know, really visualizing a little more. Different SWR values on a 50-ohm transmission line as a result of terminating the line with various values of impedance. This is basically what we're doing, right? Over.
Absolutely. I started off with the most simple case, a pure, non-reactive pair of resistors with a known visor. You now give me the next step of complication where the load is not as simple as a resistor, but it's something more general, like a real 80-meter dipole. You can, if you desire, calibrate your network analyzer for the end of your transmission line up at the top of the tower. You can calibrate the network analyzer, a modern one that has this built-in 12-point correction procedure algorithm, call it computer program. You calibrate it that way, and it will tell you not what the impedance in the shack is, which is a complicated answer. It'll tell you what is the impedance at the antenna. That gives you the option of building the matchbox or the antenna tuning network into a small weatherproof box right up at the antenna, if that's what you desire to do. It's a little bit more difficult to do that, but now your cable is always running at a low visoir, and you get minimum loss of your cable. So there is some advantage doing that. So with a properly calibrated network analyzer for the end of your cable, and you calibrate it for your particular frequency range that you want to sweep, it will tell you what is the real impedance at the terminals of the antenna at the top of the tower. And that's extremely valuable information if you properly use it. Back to you, Bill.
Okay, let me ask you something. There's a number of them, different references to doing these kind of problems. Some of them are in polar form, and some are in tangular form. Is there advantage to one or the other, Dick? Over.
Absolutely. Each has its advantage. It's sort of like saying, hey, Dick, would you rather eat with a fork or a spoon or with a knife? And the answer is yes, yes, yes. I'm a fork, spoon, and knife person. I use all three. And if I was Oriental, I would be using chopsticks. You know what I'm saying. Certain kind of impedance matching works best in polar form. Certain kinds of impedance matching and equations works best in rectangular form. when you're using the conventional equations on a handheld calculator, like the one that I own, a Hewlett-Packard 28, I can put in complex numbers. I can easily convert a impedance number into a admittance number by simply pressing the 1 over X key. I press that key, and my admittance values become a impedance value, and vice versa. So if I'm doing a series addition of a matching element, be it an L or a C, but if I'm doing it in series, I do it in resistive terms, impedance terms. If I'm putting a shunt element across the network, a shunt capacitor or a shunt inductor, I do it in the admittance terms. I press the 1 over X key before putting in the admittance of the new component. And so there, when I'm doing it as an exact calculation, the rectangular form is handiest. When I'm displaying it on a Smith chart, the polar form is handiest. Do I use polar forms in the equations in the calculator? I think the answer is no. The polar form does have one other great advantage. The polar form is a exact magnitude with a phase angle. The exact magnitude is a reflection coefficient that you plug into the Vizwa formula. So if I want to convert it back into Vizwa, or I want to convert it back into reflection coefficient, S11, in decibels, then the polar form is the handiest. But when I'm doing the impedance matching itself, the rectangular form is handiest. They both work very well in the right place. Back to you, Mel.
W2ZL repeater.
Okay, very good. Just curious about one more thing. You know, just as I read on and all and do more and more in-depth study here, I was thinking, if the magnitude of the impedance mismatch is, how do I put this, is pure resistance, Dick, could I use a simpler form of just saying, well, instead of going through, you know, like for instance, if it's a complex impedance, I'm going to have to use, you know, R plus JX. But if it's a pure resistance relationship, would it be easier to use R over Z sub C or Z sub C over R? Is that really, you know, in other words, could I simplify it if it is a pure resistance relationship, Dick, by not going into R plus JX for complex measurements over?
Absolutely. But there's a catch. If my antenna was some particular standing wave ratio, but it was a pure resistor, like in my previous example, 25 ohms because I got a pair of 50 ohm resistors in parallel, that's what exists right at the antenna terminals. If I was doing the impedance match at the antenna terminals, I could use the simplest one in the world, a simple transformer. All I would need is a 2-to-1 impedance ratio transformer right at the antenna, at the end of the feed line, and I've got a perfect match. And 2-to-1 impedance match is a 1.414 turns ratio. So 14 turns on the primary, 10 turns on the secondary, 14.1 turns, so to speak, on the primary, and 10 turns on the secondary. I now match 50 ohms resistive to 25 ohms resistive. You simply wind that transformer with 10 turns on the secondary and 14 turns on the primary, mount it right at the antenna at the end of the feed line, and you got a perfect match. Common sense would lead you to believe if I decide to put the transformer in the shack instead of at the antenna, that I should get the same performance. Uh-uh. In the shack, I've now added 50 feet of cable. My 50-ohm resistor calibrated in the shack, not the cable calibrated, the network analyzer is calibrated in the shack, and I connect it to that cable. I'm now walking around that Smith chart in that great big 2-to-1 circle. And so, therefore, at each individual frequency, I'm at a different point on the circle on that Smith chart, and I need a different network. A simple transformer won't do it. Ain't that crazy? The transformer at the antenna, if the antenna was pure resistive with a 2-to-1 Vizwa, very easy. That same transformer in the shack won't work. You need a more complicated network because of what the transmission line does. The transmission line is a certain delay line, which has got a certain number of phase shift at 3 megacycles. It's got twice the amount of phase shift in degrees at 6 megacycles. That gives you some idea as to why the reflected signal coming back into the shack shifts in funny ways. The Smith chart is really telling you the radius of the circle is telling you the magnitude of the reflection coming back from the load. The angle of the vector on the chart, the vector you draw from origin out to your circle, the angle by comparison to the right-hand side of the chart, that phase angle represents the phase shift two ways of your cable. So the cable is creating phase shift that is frequency sensitive. That's why the Smith chart traces out a circle. That's why the simple transformer don't work in the shack anymore, even though it would work on the top of the tower for that particular 50-ohm resistive antenna, 25-ohm resistive antenna. K2KUI, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Very good.
Automatic control operator change. Over.
Very good, Dick. Yeah, I guess more or less beating around basically what you were saying there, and the confusing points, it just more or less clarified what I actually was seeing with, different complexities, and I guess I started crossing over from rectangular form back to polar form, and back and forth, and back and forth, and I keep losing sight, and I have to keep going back and saying, that in polar form, if I have 50 ohm impedance and an angle of 0 degrees, I'm going to have an SWR essentially of 1, which is going to actually give me a 50 plus J0. So, when you have to visualize these two things and go on like that, it gets a little hairy. And that's basically, I have to keep going back many times, because I get this, this business of going from rectangular form back to polar form and all, and then doing some of the calculations, they can become very, very confusing there. Especially when you just, as you said, when we come to a relationship of pure mismatch where the pure resistance, we've got another situation in there. You got to know, if it's a complex impedance situation. So, all these calculations can become a real, unless you're working with them constantly, I can see where you can go to get yourself into a lot of problems because, sticking with the rectangular form of R plus J X is one situation compared to converting it over to, but I guess converting it, once you're in rectangular form, I guess it's easy enough, to maybe go from rectangular form and convert it over to polar form, I guess. Is that the best way to go over?
Okay, from now on, we've got to make sure we wait for the beep. If you own a calculator, this old, ancient thing that I love so much called the Hewlett-Packard 28S, 1988 technology, I carry it in my pocket every day. If I take your 40 plus J30, which I'm going to plug in right now as we watch, open parentheses, 40, 30, enter. There it is. And I've set my calculator so that the command keys on the top of the right-hand half of the calculator, right under the screen, are set in the complex mode. There is a key called rectangular arrow polar. There is a key called polar dash rectangular. I'm in rectangular form, 40, 30. If I press the key called R-P, it says 50.0 ohms magnitude, 36.869 degrees phase. One keystroke did all of that complex conversion from rectangular to polar. If I now press the polar to rectangular, back pops my 40, 30. To do that with pencil and paper will drive you up a wall, and you can easily make a mistake. You got the right calculator, you got the right command screen, you press one key and it happens, and there it is. And it saves you a mountain of time. And Hewlett Packard almost never makes a mistake. I do. It doesn't. And so when it comes to working out these problems, I use that machine every day. If I make the mistake of leaving it at the factory when I come home or leaving it at home when I go to the factory, I have a panic. I got to go back. Got to go back and get the thing. I solve the problem by buying more of them, leaving one at the factory and one at home. There's always one, and there's a spare in the drawer, just in case. Because without that security blanket, I'm in a lot of trouble. Psychologically, got to have it. I'm addicted to the damn thing. You can see why. It solves the problem instantaneously. The batteries that work in this calculator are good for 2 years. I don't have to worry about charging the damn thing. I can be on an airliner flying from here to California, solving the problem, if that's what I want to do. If I happen to be, you know, a white-knuckle flyer, and I'm flying the airplane, I want to do something to get my mind off it, I can solve all these great problems with that calculator. I don't have to worry about my laptop computer with an exploding Sony battery. That, to me, is a solution. Works like a charm. So, rectangular to polar, polar to rectangular, good to learn, the right calculator, which you can now buy on...
Long-winded. Repeater. Time out. 3 seconds.
As I was saying, you can now buy it on eBay for about $100. Real good investment, in my opinion. And if you treat it correctly, it lasts a long time, the battery doesn't go dead, and it solves the problem like a charm. You feel uncomfortable with these polar to rectangular, rectangular polar, Smith chart, end of the cable, beginning of the cable, all of this jazz. It just takes practice, Mel. It is a very good practice to make. You'll use it for the rest of your life. Once learned, it's like learning how to ride a bicycle. You'll be a little bit shaky if you come back to the bicycle in 5 years. But within a half hour, you'll be riding very well, and you'll be riding the bicycle with you on it upside down, if you know what I mean, backwards. I can ride a two-wheel bicycle backwards when I'm in good practice. No, I get onto the bicycle with my face facing toward the rear wheel and my back facing toward the front wheel, and I grab the handlebars behind me, and I start pedaling backwards, and I can run the bicycle that way. I have some fun teaching people in a park how to do that. So, by the same token, it's a good thing to learn. It's just a matter of practice. All of this jazz is not common sense at first. It'll drive you up a wall at first. It seems very unfamiliar. But you just keep practicing at the problem. You keep asking people how to solve this. You find little books that will give you hints on how to do it. And it's a good thing to learn. Once you become comfortable with it, you suddenly realize that the RF in transmission lines and antennas is not quite that magic, not quite that mysterious. It'll take out a little bit of the mystique for you of wireless, but still, you'll come out ahead. Go for it, Mel. K2KEY, KQRIW in the TechNet.
Imperial.
Stand by a minute, Mel. Go ahead, Steve.
Okay, well, I work in the industry. I guess you know that, but I think the best tool out there is actually a Smith chart. You know, you can visually see what's going on. So you don't really have to go through a lot of complex math. You know specific points on the Smith chart. You know, I put a shunt cap over here, and it's going to go right to the middle. That's just my opinion.
You're absolutely right, Steve. That's one very, very good tool. And if you're smart enough to be able to flip back and forth across the center of the Smith chart, you're going from an impedance chart to a 1 over impedance. I keep forgetting the words. Not susceptance, admittance. You keep flipping back and forth between an impedance chart and an admittance chart. When you're using shunt elements and series elements, it allows you to get to an answer quite fast. And for every one of these impedance matching problems, there's at least 2 answers. You can do it with the shortest possible cable length, or you can do it with a slightly longer cable length. And some answers are better than the other. The good thing about the Smith chart is it's visual and fast and usually works right. The bad news of the Smith chart, if you're doing a complex reaction conversion, where you're doing 2 or 3 steps and you lose a little bit of accuracy on each one, your answer starts coming out in the ballpark, but it misses home plate. Whereas if you do it with a handheld calculator, on the assumption your raw data was accurate, you come out with an answer that's accurate to 10 decimal places. The HP28 does all of its internal calculations to 12 decimal places. The answer you get on the screen is at least good to 9 or 10. So there are times when that's the right way to go. I'll admit that that calculator doesn't have the ability to display a Smith chart on it. Some of the handheld calculators, some of the TIs and the later versions of the HP, the HP 48 and 49, will display a Smith chart on the screen for you, as well as a good network analyzer will do that. Now, a network analyzer, let me drop, ordinarily is a pretty expensive machine, and the ones you can get on eBay are so many generations old, and that particular science has moved so fast, I almost don't recommend buying one of those old things that are on eBay. And I don't recommend you spend $40,000 for a new one. There are impedance measuring things made by AEA and other companies like that, which will give you amplitude and phase angle. That allows you of reflection coefficient on your transmission line. That allows you to go to the calculator or to the Smith chart, whichever you like, and get the answer from there. So with a couple of $100 of AEA instrumentation, you can do this kind of work, the poor man's equivalent of that $40,000 network analyzer. K2KEY, K2IW in the TechNet.
Roger, that's what I have, the AEA. And the graphic display is wonderful to work with to begin with, but also you have the cable that comes from it, and you can then plug into your computer and with the software do a lot more complex measurements or do more analysis of your measurements. And basically, because, I'm actually, what am I doing? I've been fooling with this loop, trying to get the, different characteristics of it and try to screen out what's fact and fiction. And, I also am using the calculator, basically. When I just plugged in, when 40 plus J30 in rectangular form, and I get 50, Z, let's see, Z of 50 and the angle of 36.9 degrees. Do you get the same thing, Dick, over?
Almost. I get 50 degrees real and magnitude and angle 36.869897-6458. I'm telling you the truth. Do you need all those decimal places? Of course not. And yes, is that 36.9? Of course. You're absolutely right. Go ahead, Bill.
I have a question.
Go ahead, Steve.
It's a piece of AEA equipment. It actually gives you a Smith chart graph of your impedance.
Go ahead, Bill.
No, it doesn't give you a Smith chart. There's a new one that they came out with now that will give you a Smith chart directly, but this one you have to go through the software. In other words, you can take the information stored and then go through the software connecting it up to your computer. The idea is that the handheld is a portable unit that you can take it right out, and work outside or wherever with a runoff, just a bunch of pen light batteries. And it's lightweight, but of course now with laptop computers and all that, it's of course, I've been advanced quite a bit. My unit here is, I guess, is at least... it's 5-6 years old Steve, over.
Okay, it gives you magnitude and phase, phase angle and a magnitude. I could actually do an impedance match that way, and what's the frequency range?
Okay, they got several versions of it. They got an HF version, they got, I don't know what's available anymore. There was one that the HF version that I have, which goes from 160 through 10 meters, and then they had one that they came out with that covered 6 meters through 2 meters, and then another one for the UHF band. And with the software, you can do quite a bit. Yes, you can measure magnitude, you can complex impedance, actually convert it into a Smith chart trace, it's rudimentary in that what is available today, Steve. Over.
Okay, well, I have a microwave simulator that can actually make Smith chart if you gave me the magnitude and phase anyway, but there are actually applications on the internet I've seen. In fact, there's one online. It's like a Smith chart tool. It's really good learning. I turned on some of the technicians at work to understand how to impedance match and what's going on with the Smith chart. I just don't remember the exact address right now. I found it by accident. And maybe I can email Dick with the address, because I think it's very important to learn the Smith chart. Once you learn that, you're going to find that RF is a lot easier.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I use the Smith chart all the time. This is just another, just talking about different applications that were suggested by like Walt Maxwell and John Krauss, who basically did a lot of things amazing. John Krauss, what he did, and then he's gotten his 1950 book on antennas, Dick, is just phenomenal that he was able to, you know, do so much with such simple equipment, more or less with, I don't know, I guess he used one of these calculators that, you know, you had a hand grind over.
W2VL repeater.
Yeah, there's a good chance that he did use the Kurter calculator, that little round thing that you grind to give you answers, and it gave very good answers in its day. And there's also desktop calculators with a roll of paper coming out of them. That's what he used, and he got some darn good answers, because from his ham radio experience, John Krauss had a good understanding of what's really happening at the molecular level, so to speak, of his transmission line, of his coax cables, and of his radio telescopes and so on. If you get a chance to go to a library and see the third edition of Krauss, which was published just before he died, I think it's 1992, 94, it's got a nice antenna pattern on the front cover of this hard copy book. Unfortunately, it's a $120 book, but they added a whole lot of computer-generated graphics to demonstrate the principles, and they added some more chapters. I own all three copies of Krauss, version edition 1, 2, and 3, and they got better and better. But in his day, in 1950, that McGraw-Hill book was a real breakthrough. That was the Bible of the antenna world at that time. Let me drop. And the only thing that replaced it was Jacek's book, Antenna Engineering Handbook, 1981, McGraw-Hill. And the latest version of it has got a lot of more computer-generated graphics, pictures, more chapters, and each of the 42 chapters are written by an expert in that particular field of that particular kind of antenna. But as I've discovered in the last month, as I'm doing my research on the right way to set up an outdoor reflective ground plane antenna range, which seems to be the world's best kept secret, I looked at all these books to find out which one of them tell you how to properly set up an outdoor antenna range. My favorite book that I keep jumping up and down about, the Jacek Antenna Engineering Handbook. All 42 chapters have not a word on how to make the measurements on an outdoor antenna range. The Krauss's book, first and second edition, have a couple of words that by modern day concepts are wrong. The third edition starts getting into the subject, but doesn't go very deep. The Scientific Atlanta book, Hollis Clayton, and I can't think of the third guy's name, a self-published book by Scientific Atlanta. Let me drop. It's got a lot of words on the subject, but they ain't written in English. If you're not deep into the antenna testing world, you'll say, I'm not going to plow through all this stuff. It just got page after page of equations and derivations and very few diagrams. It's there, but it's not clear. The first guy to pull it all together and make it in human-friendly speech was Dr. Dick Turin, W2IMU of Bell Labs, and he put it in 1974 November issue of QST magazine. He boiled all this stuff down into a nice set of graphs and two or three very simple equations to tell you how to set up an antenna range in the outdoors, and all the antennas below 1,000 megs, with rare exception, are all measured outdoors in the presence of ground reflection. And if you're smart enough, you find out how to make ground reflection work in your favor instead of against you. You don't run away from it, you run toward it, and you use it to your advantage. And if you're smart enough, you put the source antenna low to the ground. Ordinarily, common sense would say, ground reflection is bad, let's get away from it, let's put all the antennas up high, the source antenna and the antenna under test. Dead wrong. Good common sense, wrong. antenna on the ground, so close to the ground, that the antenna being tested at its magic altitude, at its magic range, looks at the real antenna above ground, the mirror image of the antenna below the ground, they're both in phase at that angle and that range, and it resolves them as one simple source. It can't tell that there's two things there. It thinks it's one, and it just thinks the one is twice as loud, and it's happy with that, and it can be properly calibrated. It was Dr. Gaturin in 1974, November issue of QSD, that finally put that into human-friendly speech, user-friendly engineering form. And it finally got reproduced in the ARRL antenna book, and it's shoved into the back of the chapter on propagation, well hidden. Most people working in the antenna testing science don't know it is hidden in the ARRL antenna book. It's been in plain sight since the end of 1974. They suddenly realized how valuable that was, and they wrought it into that edition of the antenna book, the antenna handbook, that QST was coming out with at that time, and they've left it there in every edition since 1974. Thank goodness. But you go to any good antenna testing laboratories, and I've been at the two that arguably are the best in the world. Let me drop. One is at Edwards Air Force Base. It's called the Benfield Anechoic Facility. It's a $10 million chamber. And I've been using the one also at the Rome Air Development Center in Newport, New York. And that's also another $10 million installation. Two antenna testing facilities on top of two mountains, a mile and a half apart, all interconnected by fiber optics and cables. And both of these world-class, the best thing the Air Force owns, United States Air Force, one on the West Coast, one on the East Coast, both of them, you visit that laboratory, you will not see a copy of the ARRL antenna book sitting on their shelf. The one in Newport, New York, happens to be doing a very good ratiometry antenna range measurement. I happened to write one of the articles on ratiometry antenna range, February 1976 QST. And also I gave an IEEE presentation on that subject. The Benfield Anechoic Facility out at Edwards Air Force Base I can't think of the name of the town now, in California, Lancaster, California, they've just got a chamber that is so darn big that it does work down at those low frequencies, but it's an acre and a half of chamber, 300 feet square, 7 stories high, a great big shielded room, lined with 250,000 square feet of anechoic material. $10 million chamber, which, by the way, is worth $14 million. That's what it really cost to build, but that's another whole story. And I'm one of the guys that tuned up that chamber the first time in 1989 and 1990, and so to speak, made it work. We had a particular project going that time that we had to make that chamber work, otherwise our product that was being produced, that was being tested in that chamber, would have looked like it wasn't worth buying. And eventually they bought $3.5 billion worth of. That's another story. So what I'm getting at is outdoor antenna range testing is an art and a science that is not very well understood, very poorly documented. The only other book that's got a little bit of the information is the IEEE Antennas and Propagation Standard Dictionary of Antenna Testing Terms. How many people have got a copy of that rare text? Very few. So the good books that tell you how to test antennas on an outdoor range almost don't exist. I'm writing an article on that subject and trying to tell people this is the reason why you guys have had so much trouble. The few people who have got it keep it close to their chest. They consider it proprietary information, and they ain't telling the outside world how they do their testing. It's been a well-kept secret. That's a crime. When 90-some-odd percent of all the antennas being used by mankind are below 1,000 megs, and all of the thousands of chambers, almost none of them work below 1,000 megs, therefore, all of the antennas, if they're tested at all, are tested in an outdoor antenna range, and they're all being tested by a procedure that is black magic. And very few are doing it right. And very few know what the hell they're doing when they do it at all. And the answers they get sometimes are fairly crazy. You get major manufacturers of television aerials claiming gains that are tend to be higher than the laws of physics can possibly allow. And because nobody can test it to confirm it, everyone believes it. And people buy antennas by what the advertisement number says, not what is really confirmed and traceable to the Bureau. Craziness. Anybody got any further comments on all this? I'm on one of my favorite hobby horses, as you can tell. KQLAW on the TechNet.
W2VL, repeater.
2APG. Mr. APG, start over with your name, sir, and then proceed.
Yeah, hi, Dick. It's Dave. Slightly different topic. I just want to know what happened to the Honda.
I bought that car thinking I'm going to use it for 1 year as a roller skate, as a carryover, until I went out and bought a Land Rover, Land Cruiser, Safari wagon. That's what I thought I was going to buy. I found out how expensive those are, and they get 12 miles to the gallon. I said to myself, how the hell can the Brits make an engine that bad that gets 12 miles to the gallon? I didn't buy the car. I sat back for the next 4 years and did nothing. Finally, at 200,000 miles, the control arm started falling apart, and the car was about to become dangerous. It wouldn't pass inspection, and it would take $1 zillion to replace the control arms, and it would only take an amount of money that was 10 times what the car is worth. And I finally bailed out, and just this weekend, I traded in for another vehicle. And what's really crazy, Dave, is I shined it all up, cleaned it all out, took all the dirt out of it, removed all my adapters that were buried under the seats, and my pieces of coax cable, and my books, and my office was that car for the last 4 years, my traveling office. And so I shined it all up when I abandoned it. And I said, what is wrong with this picture? N2APG, K2RAW.
Isn't that the way it always is, though? You know, when you polish the car and shine it up and, finally wash it, something happens. So the engine was still good then. The control arms, that's like some kind of mechanical thing in the front by the steering, I guess. So the engine was still running.
Like a charm. Let me drop. For those who, now that the story is over, I can tell you, I bought a car from Dave's family and at an extremely good price. And it was a carryover car, just to give me some kind of transportation until I went out and bought a real car. And the damn thing gets 25 miles to the gallon, it just keeps rolling, you just keep pouring fluids into it. Occasionally you give it a battery or an alternator or some new radiator fluid, and it just keeps on running. And I had to give it a new hose one time for the power steering. But I guess I put 80,000 miles or something like that on the car, and finally I had to bail out because there's three times in my life, Dave, when a car came close to killing me. The first one was my first Corvair, where the lower ball joint came apart. But it came apart in the AIL parking lot when I was moving 3 miles an hour. Had that happened the night before, when I was testing out the car at a high speed on the William Floyd Parkway, that convertible would have flipped over at some ridiculous speed. It would have dragged upside down in a convertible with me in it, and you know what would happen from my shoulders up. That came close to killing me. 10 years ago, a station wagon of mine, the upper ball joint came apart, and the wheel flopped in a crazy way, jammed itself into the wheel well, destroyed the tire, and the car again would have flipped over, but I was moving 5 miles an hour, turning into a parking lot at Roy Rogers in Huntington. Thank goodness it didn't happen on a high speed. Now, with the case of the Honda, let me drop. I was hearing a funny clunking sound, and it didn't pass inspection. They wanted $1 zillion, and I said, no, I'm not going to go for it. And I decided to give it my own inspection. I put it up on a jack, took the wheel off, and I wiggled that upper ball joint, and I said, wow. The thing, I could move it back and forth a quarter of an inch, half an inch. It's ready to come apart. And every day I make a trip on the Long Island Expressway, and everybody's going at 70 miles an hour, and the cars are parked in tight, you lose the upper ball joint on the control arm of an automobile. That wheel leaves the car virtually. The whole top of the wheel flops over at whatever angle it wants, jams itself in the wheel well, and you're moving at some ridiculously high speed. The car will climb over that wheel and flip upside down. You do that at 70 miles an hour on the expressway in the third lane, packed in tight, and your car is now sliding upside down on the expressway, and everyone else is going to ram into you, and you can't even climb out of it. I think you see the scene. Now I know why for the last month I'm hearing this funny clunking sound as I drive out of my driveway onto my main street. And so I had the choice of either spending the $1 zillion to get that repaired or abandon it. And I finally abandoned it. That's the sad sailor row, Dave, into APG, K2RIW.
Well, it's a good thing they have these state inspections and, you know, they picked it up before you had an accident, because like you say, that would have been a bad thing. What did you replace it with?
I used Toyota Camry. Go ahead.
Okay. I was thinking maybe some kind of SUV or van or something like that where you could put all sorts of stuff into it. You know, these little Hondas, they're great cars. The Japanese cars are fantastic, you know, commuting and things like that. But, you know, you can't put a lot of stuff into them.
You're right. The Camry is sort of, I would call it a midsize. I walked into the dealer yesterday in Smithtown. I said, I really want 4 doors and 4 wheels. And he says, how many dollars are you willing to spend? And I gave him a number. He says, great. I got lots of things. He showed me all kinds of SUVs. I was tempted, but all the SUVs he had were weird colors that I couldn't tolerate. See, I drive a car into the ground, as you can tell. So whatever I buy, it better look kind of pretty, because I'm going to look at it for the next 5 or 7 years. And so the colors they had available, I couldn't tolerate. Some of the mileages were good. Some of the performances were good. Some of the brand names were good. But the colors were yucky. I said, walk me around the parking lot and show me something else. And he showed me this beautiful maroon-colored thing. And it was love at first sight. Buying a car on the color just because it's got 4 doors, 4 wheels, a good brand name, and a good reliability and crash record. That's enough to sell me. And so I went to contract. And then I then went to a Carfax and found out exactly what that VIN number had been through. I then went to Kelly's Blue Book and found out what the resale value is. And I came back the next day and handed them that paperwork and said, even though we went to contract and even though I gave you a deposit, take a look at these numbers. We renegotiated. We came up with something that made him happy, made me happy. It's a win-win, and I got a vehicle. And it's got lots of features, but it doesn't have the roof rack for the antennas. It doesn't have the great big volume for moving all my stuff. It's not the usual station wagon or SUV or Land Rover that I thought I was going to end up with. But it may be at my stage of life, it's time I buy a second car along with my business car. This is my business car. That's probably what's going to be, Dave. What should I buy for a serious off-road vehicle? Got any suggestions, Dave? I don't want 12 miles per gallon.
Well, do you really need an off-road vehicle? You know, what kind of off-roading are you going to be doing? That's, you know, look at all the SUVs, the off-road, the 4x4s that are being driven by housewives and soccer moms, you know, to go back and forth to soccer practice. So do they really need, you know, the 4x4 in the snow? I don't think so. I just wanted to mention something that I saw recently, which I thought was a kind of a cool high-tech device.
Yeah, my off-road is occasionally be going to mountaintops, beachfronts, doing what they call mountaintop and microwave work on a tripod with UHF, SHF, EHF equipment. It's what I want to start doing when I really retire, whenever that'll be. And so physically, a Land Rover looks good, but it's reliability, repair, cost, and gas mileage. All are terrible. Automat is a good vehicle. It's got some great sounding features. So I guess I'm talking about off-road, recreation-like, microwave-oriented, mountain-topping capability, which unfortunately is only going to be used 5 days a year, but therefore I got to buy a used one. I can't justify buying a brand new vehicle that can do that. In fact, I love used vehicles, as you can tell. Thank you, Dave, with your suggestion.
Subaru
sounds good. We'll get you in the second stage. Go ahead, Dave. Dave first.
Okay, I was going to recommend the Subaru also. I remember this last time I was up in northern Vermont, northern New Hampshire, northern Maine. Instead of a bunch of SUVs, I saw a bunch of Subarus. And I talked to somebody local, and they said they buy them because they're so reliable.
Sounds awful good. Let it drop first, Steve, and then give us your words.
W2VL repeater.
KN2APG. The Forester is a real nice vehicle. A little small, but very reliable. They got the all-wheel drive, and I think they're real good-looking, those little boxy Foresters. I think you know what I'm talking about. I wanted to mention something real quick. I passed a highway patrol car a couple of weeks ago, and it had two funky-looking cameras on the roof of the car. One was pointed straight ahead. The other one was pointed a little off to the right. And I wasn't, I knew there were cameras, but I wasn't sure what was going on. And about two nights later, on the evening news, they had a spot on the evening news about that exact installation.
And was that a LIDAR, a laser-type radar speed-detecting device?
No, the way they explained it, the two cameras were set up. They actually scan license plates as they pass the police car, or the police car passes other vehicles. They automatically scan the license plate, goes into a computerized system, and within seconds, if there's a warrant out, or if the car is unregistered, or the car has no insurance, or any other red flags come up, the police officer is automatically notified. You know, the computer beeps, and it tells them that car is unregistered, or that guy's a felon, get him.
Fantastic. I think I've been hearing about that. Steve, KF2RL, I think you wanted to make some words. I thought I heard Steve. Maybe it was Dave. Was there anyone else that wanted to give us some words on vehicles? Okay, so that was on the news. Did they give a name for that hardware? Yes, I think I caught an edge of that chunk of news where it automatically read the plate. And I think in some of the toll booths they're starting to do that jazz also. Back to you, Dave.
Yeah, apparently, you know, this is something that they're trying out on a trial basis. You know, they probably, you know, NASA has a couple of them, maybe Suffolk has a couple of them, you know, this kind of thing. But you can't miss them because, they're very funky-looking cameras. They're mounted on the roof of the car, and then they have this thick coax that goes back over the rear windshield, and it goes into the trunk. So, it kind of looks a little like it's jury-rigged, but that's how they have them, you know, set up on the cars. And it's fascinating. You know, Big Brother is watching you. The cop, it's all passive. The cop doesn't do anything. The system just runs automatically. It's on all the time.
Yeah, for years and years, I've been hearing about computer programs that will do visual interpretation and actually read things, so to speak. Read books, pattern recognition, and whatever. That's becoming an art and a science. Speech recognition, pattern recognition. These computers are getting pretty smart. Look out. Before we put everyone to sleep, we ought to hear what Paul's got to say. WS2N, what have you been missing in space? I hear tell the people who have got good satellite watching equipment. You heard Eric telling us earlier that Mrs. Ansari, who is a guest, a $20 million guest on the International Space Station, that with the right satellite observing equipment, you can watch what she was doing on the International Space Station as a paying guest. Hopefully she was at the windows taking pictures. Hopefully she was occasionally at the ham radio equipment talking to people. But mostly looking out the windows, because I hear tell the view is something that's a mind blower that you will never recover from, so to speak. WS2N, K2RIW in the TechNet. Maybe we put Paul to sleep. We did keep him waiting too long. Anyone else with anything to discuss on all of the subjects above, give me your call letters right now.
KEY.
Mel recognized. Anyone else? You got it, Mel.
Okay. There was another book that was written. I have not been able to see it, and everybody recommends it, and I was wondering, maybe you've had a chance to, as they say, peruse it. A Look at Reflections by Walt Maxwell. Have you ever seen that book, Dick, over?
I think the title is Reflections on Reflections. Isn't that the title? And I think I've got a copy of it.
No, they told me it was A Look at Reflections. Maybe they told me, maybe he gave me the wrong name, but is it worth looking into, over?
I remember when I first saw it, I thought it was pretty good, not perfect, but very few books are. The whole subject of standing wave ratio, reflection coefficient, S11, vector reflection coefficient, what a network analyzer measures, all of this jazz, you can tell is not a simple subject. Very few books make it easy to understand and learn. What Steve knows, what I know, what you know, most of us have learned it by the hard school of knocks, by a virtual or real apprenticeship program, by being there for 5, 10, 15, 20 years. That's how we learn this jazz. The books do a medium poor job of describing that material. The college courses do a medium poor job of teaching you that material. They give you a head full of equations, but they don't relate it to the real world. A guy could ace the course in electromagnetic theory at a good bachelor level at electrical engineering school, and you assume when he graduates from that school, he's going to go out in industry and do that work. No way, Jose. He knows a few of the basics. He knows nothing practical. I've watched a couple of those wonders come out of school, go into the field, and try to do that work. And they come up with answers of, well, this network has got 287 dB of loss, and it's got a 2,000 to 1 standing wave ratio. To which you say, huh? You measured that on a what? You did it with what procedure? How did you calibrate it? How in the world did you get that answer? And do you think it's reasonable? Well, they can't answer any of those questions. And because of a lack of experience, they don't know what's reasonable. If they get an answer, they plug in the raw numbers and get an answer of 251 dB, they think that's okay. That's only a 10 with 249 zeros after it as a ratio of power in versus power out. Even if that was reasonable, you couldn't measure it. You couldn't come within a light year of getting close to making that measurement with anything that's in a laboratory that I've ever seen. So, of course, it's crazy. And so, it's a problem. The managers who've got somebody, let me drop. The managers of companies who've got somebody with that skill don't recognize how valuable and how rare that skill is. So if they get a little bit of hard time and they go into what they call operational expense control, they lay off the people with those skills. And they close down that particular department that can make those measurements. So it's a problem. I don't know if that answers your question, but let me pass it back to you and see if it's close.
Like you say, it's a complex subject, very complex. There's a lot written. I've got 2 inches, a two-inch pile of information that's just on associated subject, the loop and associated subject, so many different ideas and ways and measurements and things and people contradicting one another that, you know, it's hard to plow through and find the truth in this situation. This is just taking one, you know, particular situation. So, you know, you're dealing with a very complex subject. So, basically, you got the right idea. You're going to have to, you have to plow through it and do it actual, you know, or do actual, your own experiments, and see the results and do them under controlled circumstances, which is not always easy for, you know, an average hand to do. We don't have most likely the availability of the equipment that you would like to have, but at least to be able to get, you know, some kind of ballpark idea of really what's going on here, Dick. Over.
WB2HWW.
Howie recognized. You're absolutely right, Mel. You've done the right thing to get that AEA that gives you the raw data. You're plowing through the articles that teach you how to handle the raw data, how to manipulate it, how to convert it into something useful, how to finally make that impedance match, choose the right length of cable, the right length of stuff, or whatever. Howie and I went to a school that tried to teach us that. We both went to the same school. And Dr. Howard Boyette gave us the most amount of information in that area, but he had to go off the curriculum to do it. If he followed the normal college curriculum and taught us electromagnetic theory by the canonical method, it's memorizing a whole bunch of equations that almost do not relate to the real world. It's a rare student that's able to convert that memorization procedure into a real lab operating technique. unless the guy was simultaneously working in industry and doing that work at the same time he took that course and put the left hand and the right hand together, unless he did that, it didn't stick. It's a bunch of memorization that you walk out of there and promptly forget. You vaguely know you went through it, you curse that damn course, and you say, gee, that didn't give me useful engineering information in a form that I could go out and earn a living with. Whereas you take the computer science course, and they gave you information that you can go out there and you can start learning a living with it. I wonder if you'd experience anything somewhat similar to that. The labs that were taught by Boyette gave us quite a bit of real information. The labs and the classes taught by K2BUS, I can't think of his name now, I just said it before. He gave us the most practical information.
Long-winded. Repeater, time out.
You got it, Howie. WB2HWW, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Talking about Seidman, yeah. Seidman. What a great guy he was. Yeah, he taught circuit design. I loved his stuff when we did op amps. I loved the fact we did monolithic. When I took him, we made our own IC chips in the lab. I was just going to make a comment, Dick. Just to let you guys know, Dick, I've been playing with a 10-meter repeater on 29.66, 29.560 with a PL of 140. I'm getting some amazing results compared to UHF. Running mobiles, running 80 to 100 watts, we're getting 70 and 80 mile ground wave.
Doesn't surprise me, Howard. The guy's on 70 to 80 meter ground wave. Wow. Yeah, the guys on 6 meters see a lot more range on their repeaters when they're set up right than the guys on 2 meters. And 10 meters would have to be more of the same. When you get a band opening on 10 meters, it's going to get a little crazy. But the lower the frequency, as long as you're still in the free VHF region, 30 to 300 megs to 300, and 29 is close enough. As long as you're in the VHF region where the noise of the atmosphere is somewhat low, the noise figure you can come up with modern-day preamps is somewhat great. You can generate power very easily. The antenna itself has got a huge capture area compared to a UHF antenna. The bottom line, all that, is great range. The foliage attenuation is a hell of a lot lower. The trees are a lot more transparent at 29 megs than they are at 2 meters. And at 2 meters, they're more transparent than they are at 450. So as you go down in frequency, with the same schematic of hardware, the same number of dB gain of the antenna, and the same number of watts out of the transmitter, you end up with a hell of a lot more range. I'll bet you the range goes up by 2 to 1 every time you go 4 to 1 in frequency. It's a square root of frequency phenomenon. That's what I think. So it's 1 over the square root of frequency is the ratio of the ranges you get when you go down, Howie. That's what I think you're seeing. How long has that repeater been operational? And how many people are on it so far? Back to you, sir.
I'll say half a dozen tied to the UHF machine. But it does have noise. You know, you got to deal with noise. You don't really want preamps. I would say, even if you get a half a microvolt, the receiver up there is about 0.15, 117, 118 dBm for a 12 dB quieting signal. You could probably, and I do want to talk to you on the phone because I need to build a filter. I might use a crystal filter or a front-end filter pre-selector. But just want to say it's on the air and people can try it. It's tied into UHF. It's a split-site machine. And Dick, yeah, I remember Boyette. And I had other people, I had other courses in magnetic engineering, you know, magnetic waves and theory. And when I walked out of that class, I forgot it completely.
You're not at all alone, Howie. We all forgot it because it was just one great big memorization of vector equations, del operator equations. I think you've heard me say many times, I met one human being who drastically enjoyed that course. And I asked this lady engineer, why did you enjoy the course? And she said, I'm a math major. It's a great piece of mathematics. I didn't have the vaguest idea what it meant, but I loved the math. I'm glad she got something out of it. But the fact that the course is so non-